Hello, this is David Brim, and I'm the founder of Orlando Entrepreneurs. We are the hub for Orlando entrepreneurship, and our mission is to connect, cultivate, and celebrate our local entrepreneurs. We bring together our local entrepreneurial ecosystem to help impact our entrepreneurs, their companies, and our local economy. Learn more at OrlandoEntrepreneurs.org. Now over to Josh Wilson to get forward with our show.
Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Orlando Entrepreneur Show. I'm Josh. I'm your host. And I'm going to be guiding you guys through Orlando, meeting some of Orlando's finest founders and entrepreneurs and people who support and invest in the entrepreneurial community here in your backyard in beautiful Orlando. On today's show, we're going to have a conversation with Ryan Smith, who is the founder and principal of Elevation Capital Group. They've done over $500 million worth of deals. So if you're wanting to know about deal flow, about capital, about how deals are structured, like you want to listen in on the show because we're going to dissect things and we're going to have a great conversations about deals. All right. So ladies and gentlemen, welcome Ryan to the show. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is exciting. So Ryan, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
So my name's Ryan Smith from Orlando, born here. So I'm a Orlando native, love it here. My wife and I started a firm many years ago. So we are in the mobile home park and self-storage business is the summation of it. And we own property in total of about 30 states. And so our job every day is to look for new deals out there and improve the ones that we currently own. That's the simple. And then obviously the fun part, sending checks to those who participate with us. But nice. That's a short story.
So which came first, the marriage or the business?
That's a good question. That's a dicey question.
Yeah.
No, I'm teasing. So my wife and I actually started the business when we were dating.
Okay.
We met at the Cheesecake Factory in Winter Park, table 93. So if anybody's single, not yet married.
That's the table to go to, right?
It worked for me. So all I can say is it worked for me.
Yeah.
So in short, we met. She was going to school. I owned some property at the time. She was in the property management business. She worked for a company out at UCF, University Commons, I believe. She was a property manager there. So we met and decided to start a business while we were dating. And then we continued to build after we got married. And it hasn't stopped since.
All right. So this is really exciting. When talking to a girlfriend about, you know, building a business, did you have any worries? Because a lot of the conversations we're going to have is about affiliations, about affiliates, and about partnerships, right? So one of your first partnerships was with a girl you were dating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what went through your head?
You know, I don't think I was, I've never been really accused of being an overly deep thinker. Somewhat kidding. But in short, I'm more future looking, forward looking, rather than, you know, other things. So when Jamie and I were dating, you know, I bought her a car because she needed a new car. I didn't have any kind of agreement. You know, she could have broken up with me, kept the car, but I would also say she was well worth the risk. You know, so with Jamie, she's incredibly bright. She's incredibly talented in ways that I'm not, which is important in a partnership, I think, anyway. She wanted to go to law school, so she had a professional bent. And I just thought what we could do together would be far greater than what a school and a profession would provide. And I think she's not here right now to affirmatively state that that was the case, but I think she would state so.
Yeah, we're going to follow up with her later on and make sure everything you're telling us
exactly.
is true, right?
Smart man.
All right, so you guys got married and you started acquiring properties,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, did you start small? Because you had some properties before marriage. Mm-hmm. Did you start small or did you kind of go for bigger stuff with syndication?
Oh, so we would say we don't try to start small or try to go big. It's just the next best step right in front of you. And whatever that creates, it creates. Everything else is, in my opinion, feigned and creates stress around ideals that may or may not be, you know, happen. So in short, I had started a software company when I was a teenager, built it up. And so coming out of college, had a software company that was doing quite well. So we had capital, thankfully. I had good credit. We had the software application that I built. It was for investors to help them make better financial decisions on their investments. It had an install base of about 140,000 users worldwide. So I had the software application, capital, credit. Jamie had property management know-how. And so it was just the perfect, you know, condition. So we came together and we started buying single-family residential in Orlando. And we still own many of those properties in and around town. Kind of single family, own it for 30 years, have the tenant pay it off. You know, the standard kind of model. That's what my parents had done. That's what Jamie's parents had done. And so that's what we started with. We quickly realized we had, you know, we acquired in our early 20s more than, call it 20, 25 homes, you know, so built a decent, you know, I don't know if that's big or small for us. It was just the next best step, you know? And so once we got to, let's say 25 properties, we started to realize it wasn't scalable. You know, you would think, you know, when you go to Costco and you buy 100 rolls of toilet paper, you get a discount because of the volume. So our thought is if you buy 25 homes, managing them should be more cost effective. You should have more margin in your business. And that wasn't the case, or didn't appear to be the case for us. So our thought was, okay, well, we thought margin would appear at 25. Now it's not. So when will it appear? 100, 500? How much do we have to do to get more efficient? And so ultimately we said, we're not quite sure if at all that is the case. And so we decided to pursue a better business within real estate. So we spent about a year researching every asset class under the sun, billboards, apartments, hotels, motels, industrial, retail, the gamut. And the two that, from an analytical standpoint, from a risk-adjusted basis, for the purpose of creating income, creating equity over time, tax benefits, and then cycle resiliency. And what I mean by that is we didn't want to invest in something that the income or the revenues yo-yoed up and down based on whatever the market did. So we wanted off the roller coaster ride as much as we could. And so the two asset classes that we settled on, and that was backed by our research, was mobile home parks and self-storage. And mobile home parks was an interesting one because it was a surprise to me. And to make it real short, one of the things we found, my grandfather's a very successful investor, brilliant man, took a little, made it a ton through just strategic investing. And as a kid, he would pound into all of his grandkids' minds the value of a moat or a differentiating factor in a business. And so what I saw in my early 20s, as we're doing this research, is a moat hiding in plain sight. And the best way I'd put it is, so it's interesting. So Coke and Pepsi have spent about $1 trillion in marketing, right, in their lifetimes. And the whole purpose of it is to get you, the listener, to make a decision as to how you view their product, right? So if we were to poll everybody listening today, do you like Pepsi? Do you like Coke? It'd be about 50-50 split, plus or minus.
What's yours?
this is my MO, neither.
Okay.
but I'd take Coke. I'll pick Coke. So the point is, most people would be, if you have to pick one, it'd be about 50-50. So after $1 trillion spent, they're 50% effective. Okay, so now in mobile home park business, if I buy a mobile home park, I spend no dollars and 100%, and I'll put it to you on who are listening, 100% of everybody listening to this, you know, recording would probably say that you understand the value of mobile home park, you're good for the product and the service it provides, but you just don't want one next to your house, right? So the point is, mobile home parks, there's a stigma, they're needed everywhere, they're not allowed anywhere because they're hated everywhere. And so the interesting thing, when I say hated, you can say hated, disliked, not approved, that it's all under the same. But the point is, if you go to a community and you say, we want to build a new mobile home park anywhere, 100% of the people there will say no. So $1 trillion to get a 50% effective rate in terms of a perception on a brand. And for me, I don't have to spend a penny and 100% of the people feel a certain way about the product. And you may say, well, that's terrible. That's a negative perception.
Sure.
But it's positive in the sense that if I buy a mobile home park in that community every single day is going to wake up and prevent anybody new from coming in. They can't get rid of me, but what they're doing every single day
is
keeping out all my competition. And I don't have to spend a penny for the moat that is standing there. And so it's the beautiful part of the business is, if you're listening to this and today you say, you know, mobile home parks is this is the worst thing I've ever heard of. I don't know why I'm listening. All I would ask you to do is please tell everybody, vocalize your feelings, tell everybody, spread that message widely, because in short, you're helping protect our capital from years to come. You're perpetuating the stigma, which is a moat to our capital. And so anyway, you know, I'm joking, but you get the point.
Yeah.
But when we started, I saw this moat. I thought I was the only one who saw it. You know, not many other people saw it. I had people say, well, you know, I had relatives say, well, if your business idea doesn't work out, at least you have a place to live. you know, all of this, stuff. And, you know, lo and behold, we go out, we buy mobile home parks. It works out well, turns out well. And you know, people after many years wanted to join us because it went far better than their expectations.
Yeah. So you kind of breezed over something that I think my listeners are going, what? Whoa. Let's rewind. You built a software company when you were in high school or when you were a teenager?
Yep. I started coding when I was around 8. Ended up learning 13 languages. Started with ANSI C, Object Oriented C, Borland C, JavaScript, VBScript, Java, PHP. Got into ASP 2.0, 3.0, then .NET platform. And so anyway, I enjoyed programming, writing software. So as a kid, I would write software for my teachers. I would always look for a problem that I could solve with software.
At 8 years old?
Well, I mean, at 8 was when I the wick got lit. You know, that's kind of when I got curious and started to kind of try to figure things out. So I think the first thing I tried was like a TI-82 calculator, and I started writing programs for it, and I would sell them to other people in my class that did complex things and made them simple. So, I always liked seeing problems and solving them with software.
Okay. So then you built a software program that helps investors mm-hmm. make better investment decisions, and you had 140,000
roughly, across all my software that I ended up writing. It spawned into many programs.
Wow. So do you still have that today? Did you sell it?
I ended up licensing it to a number of firms, including one of the president's companies, yeah. Which was interesting. Got to meet him and his family, which was interesting. But that's something that I kind of sunsetted in my early 20s to focus on the broader business.
Gosh. Yeah. So when you were going to school, and did you go to college?
I did. Okay. I did. Yep. I got drafted out of high school by the Baltimore Orioles, played baseball, got drafted. So I had a choice to make, but I chose college. I played baseball for Oregon State and decided against staying out in the weather was terrible. I'm a Florida boy. It was just rain and it was dreary. I needed vitamin D. So I came back to Florida. I ended up graduating from University of Tampa, got drafted again by the Angels along the way. And so anyway, played baseball my whole way through college, got my degree, and, you know, continued to build my software company the entire time I was in college. So one of the most memorable memories was that I was on the way to a baseball game, and don't quote me on the amount. I mean, obviously it's plus or minus, but I think I was shipping off a software order for like $75,000 to a group who had bought it. And I just marveled that I think he made around $75,000 a year. And I made it in that day. Yeah. And I marveled at it.
All right. So this is going to go, you spend a lot of time educating people mm-hmm. on money, mm-hmm. on capital, on income, on cash flow. You spend a lot of time. When you were in college and these professors are talking to you about business, you had money in the bank, probably more than some of them made in a year. You were making in a day, mm-hmm. right? Like, what kind of conflict did that cause inside, or did it cause any conflict at all?
It didn't really cause it. I wouldn't describe it as conflict, but more or less, you know, certain professors would get my attention more than others based on what I saw as value in what they were teaching. There were some, like there was a professor, Alejandro Ruelas Gossi, who was at University of Tampa. He wrote for the Harvard Business Review, and he was brilliant. And so every word I hung on, I did after school projects. I would, you know, I actually went to South America, to Chile with him for an entrepreneurship contest that, you know, so the point is I would engage in some, and others I would hear, and it was, I either had a different point of view, I disagreed with what they were teaching, or it just wasn't, it was theory and not practical. And so I would get a good grade, but it would.
You know. Yeah. So I found sometimes it was hard when I was going through college and I was a real estate broker and I was building spec homes all over Central Florida. Sometimes I found it hard to listen to someone if they're saying one thing out of a textbook that's 20 years old and I'm like actually doing it in the real world. And, you know, it was hard for me to kind of bite my tongue and just fill mm-hmm. out the grade.
Yep.
But so when you graduated, found your bride at mm-hmm. Table 93,
you got it.
Got married and started accumulating, you know, residential properties, single family homes, but then you took a year off to kind of reflect and to see how could we grow and scale our business. What did that year look like as you guys were researching, thinking, planning, dreaming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. So we never stand still. So there are other businesses. So I was a part of a student loan consolidation company in Tampa, Florida, and we had roughly 200 employees and we're helping consolidate, student loans. And so there's really no period in my life where for this 6 months we sat still. And, while on the real estate side of our business, as we were growing that, when I say a year, I think it was actually probably more like 9 months. And most of the challenge of that time, and this was, my youth, is I was looking for somebody who knew something about storage and mobile home parks. Since it's in a family business, I can't go to dad, grandpa, mom, dad, uncle, all of these people. So for me, I talked to anybody who said they knew anything. And a lot of people I found didn't know as much as they said, or at least I had a different perspective or point of view. And it's the irony of being young and having ideals and having desires is you're hungry for knowledge. But the irony is the people who have it don't talk. I saw it this morning, so I'll use it as an analogy. This morning on the way from my son's kindergarten graduation, I saw a car covered in bumper stickers, right? So that car, whoever owns that car, seems to want to give me a lot of advice. And not judging them based on the car they drive, but the car is not one that I would ever want to drive. But ironically, the cars you would probably see around town that you say, hey, I might like to drive that car, you typically won't find a bumper sticker on it. So they're not at all telling you how to live your life. So generally, it's just an analogy, probably a bad one, but typically the value doesn't speak. The people who have the most value don't talk that much.
What's that say about me who gets paid to speak?
Well, no, but I think you do a good job because it takes somebody to pry open and to access and get people who don't like to talk and wouldn't otherwise to talk. So I think you're a conduit by which hopefully value can flow.
Well, we'll find out by what the audience says about
this one. for sure.
So, all right. So a few questions came to mind. You're in college. Mm-hmm. You made $75,000 on the way to one of your games. Mm-hmm. Like in college, I was scraping, some coins together at one point to buy, beer or whatever. Like, what does a college student do who just made that much money? Like, tell us, how does a college student live who's doing that well successfully?
Yeah, so to me, it's not, and this is, the money is secondary. If my account goes up or down today, it obviously up is great for what it represents. It means you obtain success, you achieved something that was rewarded in terms of, monetary. But quite honestly, I was thrilled that somebody wanted my software, that they valued what I produced. I still, to this day, anytime I made anything and saw somebody not only see it, like it, want to use it, but then utilize it to create value for themselves, forget the money. That just the utilization of the tool was thrilling. That gave me that gave me a thrill far more than the money. So the money, I didn't go on vacation. I didn't buy anything special. It just went in the account, and my account went up. So what? And I showed up the next day and worked just as hard because the account balance didn't matter.
So then what does drive a person like you? Because we talk about the money went up, that's cool. You went right back to work and just worked just as hard. So then what drives someone who's kind of hit the hierarchy of needs, right? So we covered the basic costs, we're growing our business, scaling our business, making money. What drives someone to keep on building, keep on growing, help other investors do this?
Yeah, so this, I think the answer for me, and just to be honest and answer it, lies in faith for me, because it really starts, for me, of who owns it, who's the stuff that you have or want, whose is it? And that may be a weird question, right? Whoever has it, that's whose it is. Well, by my faith, it's a little different. So to me, being a believer in Jesus Christ, the short story is, all is his. I'm a steward of what is his. And so to me, the way we utilize our capital or seek to grow capital through service of others, which that's what a business is, it's serving somebody for a profit. The business is a function of worship and gratitude. Absent that faith, absent that view, then the question is, okay, well, who do you worship? Somebody's being worshiped. And so It's either, you know, for those who have faith, worship to your creator and giving credit where credit is due, or you know, with absent that, what I see a lot of is people wrap themselves in really nice things, and it's worshiping self. You know, it's elevating oneself amongst others, which is what worship is. So I know that's a it's a religious answer, a theological answer, but to me, it all starts with, for me, faith.
So your belief system actually drives you to build more, mm-hmm. to create more, to make money. So your worship is actually making money for yourself and others.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, if my God created all people in his image, then every single one of my customers are image bearers of my God. So, you know, with that, then all should have the same amount of respect, you know, and that is, you know, every one of our customers should be treated with the utmost respect. So if you have a product or a service and you value your customers, not just in because I value them because they consume my business, but if you value them for who they are, and even beyond that, you value them for who they are because of who made them, right? That, I mean, that's a pretty significant attachment to value. And then, you know, what the world would see it, you know, just the person looking in would say, wow, they really care. They have a really good product. They really take care of their people. You know, for me, the reason why lies behind the scenes, but ultimately, you know, it should produce a better product, a better service, which is valued more by the market, which produces more profit, because that's how the market rewards value is, you know, income and profit. And so then when you have the profit, what do? You go buy yourself a Bentley? And no, I mean, that's, and by the way, I, you know, you may have an 18-year-old listening to this pod, or 22s, I want a Rolls Royce, I want a Lamborghini, I want a Ferrari. That's, you know, I'm not saying that's bad. I'm not here to, I'm just telling you my view on things, not what's right for you or wrong for you. But the I will say that my view on toys and stuff is it's a never-ending pursuit. It's a never-ending pit that you cannot throw enough money at. You buy the Lamborghini, you won't be happy enough. You'll never be happy enough. The day that I realized I was a millionaire, it poured. Torrential Florida storm. So, right, as you think, well, one day I'm going to be a millionaire, the skies are going to part, birds are going to sing, you know, and it just poured. And I was just like, well, that's anticlimactic.
Yeah.
You
know? Well, I guess I'm a millionaire.
Right. So, yeah, you know, so what? So, anyway, that's it.
Well, so this is really interesting. Do you mind if we dive into this a little bit? Could I ask you some questions?
Sure.
So your faith actually drives you. A lot of times, what I've seen growing up or with other things is people show up to church, then they take off their church hat or church tie, and then they go to work.
Yep.
Right? So you kind of combine it where when you show up to work, that is your church. That is your
mission field.
That's your mission field.
Yeah.
How did you start thinking this way? Like, walk us through, like, were you always a believer? Did this suddenly hit you? Like, what? How did this transpire?
Yeah, no, it's to be fair to your point, every Christian on the face of the planet does what you say.
Yeah.
Me included, chief amongst everybody. So the problem Christians face a lot of time, it's fair, completely fair, but also unfair, is we have a standard, and the standard is Jesus. So when you look at Jesus and you say, okay, if he is who he said he was, that's a standard that for which there is no height, right? And so a lot of times people will say, well, you're flawed. You do this, you do this. Yeah, we are, you know, against the standard, we're flawed. That's the point. So I am incredibly flawed. I do all the things that give Christians a bad rap on a daily basis. So don't let me lead you to believe otherwise. In terms of, you know, I think the way we view things today, you know, Tim Keller, just as resources, Tim Keller has been incredibly influential. My son's name's Keller. Joel Hunter in Orlando, you know, at Northland. I grew up at Northland for a number of years. My other son's name's Hunter. Ligonier Ministries in Sanford. R.C. Sproul has been influential. So basically just chewing on information and then living in community with other believers that view work as a ministry, as a calling, as something that they can do to worship God by treating people with respect. There's actually a lot of them in Orlando. It's a growing community. It's exciting. It's thrilling. And I'm incredibly encouraged.
So how do you, okay, talk to us about this community. You know, like describe it a little bit, because you know, for those looking out, we can see in.
Yeah. And if you, and if you're listening to this and you say, hey, that sounds really cool, I'd like to be a part of it, reach out, plug in. Pretty simple. They're all over the place. So there's a number of communities. So I'll give you examples that everybody can see in Google. So there's a great organization that I'm thrilled with what they're doing, run by Eddie Moreton, who was just recognized in the Orlando Business Journal. He's a friend of mine and one of my favorite people. But there's an initiative called Lift Orlando, right? And so there's a bunch of you know, kingdom-minded and not kingdom-minded people that have come around this thought of developing the Paramore District in a way that the quality of life, access to good food, everything goes up, but not in a way that pushes the community out that has been there for 100 years, you know, gentrification. So that's a very public, viewable, they're having great success at it. That's the behind the scenes are people who just want to love on people for who they are and who made them, which is really cool. Some other examples. So there's a number of giving groups. This is a completely separate concept. My wife and I are part of a number of giving groups. So it's either 12 ladies that come together, each lady, and it could be any number. So don't, you know, take this as a mandate that we, so the groups, whether it's men, co-ed, ladies, we generally meet 2 times a year. It's $2,500 a person to be a part of the group, $30,000. We open a donor advised fund with, you can do it with Schwab or National Christian Foundation, NCF Orlando, any Fidelity, whoever you want, but you can open, you know, an account. Everybody puts the $2,500 in times 12, that's $30,000. And then we, based on the fabric of our community, people who are in our direct spheres within that 12 in the group, we say, okay, this person, so there's a lady who, a friend of mine, one of my landscapers who I love is an ex-con, and he's just one of my favorite people on the face of the planet. And one of his friends, her dad died, her husband then divorced her, and her car broke down in the same month.
Oh,
she has 4 kids, and it pushed her to be homeless. And so he called us and said, this lady's an incredible lady. She's having a hard time. And so the group came around her, bought her a home, helped, you know, get her back on her feet, fixed her car, actually got her a new car. So now she owns a home. She has a car. She's able to work. She was homeless, and she was working full time with 4 kids, living off Lee Road in that hotel that's really seedy right off I-4. And Lee Road is horrible. So the point is, we're able to then invest directly to people that are in our direct spheres, people that we know. And of course, you know, to encourage you, you won't hear about this. This isn't publicized. This isn't, but there's a lot of these groups forming. So there's, I think right now in Orlando, there's probably, that I know of, probably at least 10 of these groups that have formed in the last, we had one start our first meeting last week. So the giving group concept,
like undercover generosity, right?
Well, that's if it's not undercover, then it's not humble. And if it's not humble, then it's proud. And if it's proud, it means you're trying to get something from appearing to be good.
Huh.
Right. So to me, that's going back to our statement of those who have done a lot don't speak. And it's not because they don't want to tell or share. It's just they're most of them are humble, and they'd say, I don't know anything. And it's like, no, you do. You believe me, you do.
Yeah.
But they're just, it's humility and not feigned, not false. You know, it's a truly anonymous gift, which is great. So the third aspect of community that I'm really, that I get a ton out of, a friend of mine in Orlando, Mike Kelly, who's also one of my favorite. I have a lot of
you have favorite. A lot of favorite.
I do.
People.
I love people.
Pick one.
I
right
love.
Now.
I love people. I couldn't. Yeah, but Mike Kelly is, he's incredibly gifted, incredibly talented. But what he's really good at is creating discussion and debates. So C.S. Lewis was a part of a group called the Inklings, and it was Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and 2 other gentlemen, and they would meet for beer and discuss all kinds of things. And so I always thought, man, it would be cool to have an Inklings group to be a part of. And so we, you know, Mike spearheaded it, so it's completely to Mike's credit, but he spearheaded a group called the Orlando Society. And it could, you know, generally it's a group of men that get together, although we just did a co-ed one, and it could be applied to women as well, or however you want to do it. But we meet generally once a quarter when the guys get together. It may be, you know, Corona or the house here, wherever. smoke cigars, sit around, and for 2 hours we debate. And there's a topic on the table that he throws, and it's debate. Nobody's allowed to, sit without participating. So it's 12 guys from different professional backgrounds, different faith walks, and we're debating and wrestling with things. So it's definitely not. So those kind of communities, I just love.
Yeah.
And we all leave as friends. We have different points of view, and I leave having a better appreciation for the other perspectives.
Yeah. So within the things that you do, you're the founder and principal of Elevation Capital. Mm-hmm. And you guys have doing a tremendous amount of deals. You're on the board of some nonprofits and some local organizations. Mm-hmm. And then you're involved in these community groups. Like, before we really dive deep into the Elevation Capital, could you tell me a little bit about some of the boards that you sit on or some of the things that you're focused on?
Sure. And for what it's worth, if we never get to Elevation Capital Group, I'm perfectly happy with it. So don't feel any pressure. It's okay. If you struggle with sleep, call me anytime. I'll tell you all about what we do. So a couple of the boards, my wife and I have a non-for-profit called Ryan and Jamie Smith Foundation. We're not soliciting any kind of giving. It's just something that we're have been active with historically. There's the National Christian Foundation Orlando. I'm on the Orlando chapter. I'm on the advisory board there. Really excited with what they're doing. They're doing neat things, helping givers give in different ways. I'm a, I would say, a trained facilitator. But beyond that, I really enjoy a group called Generous Giving. It's actually founded by somebody who's from and lives, or I'd say lives in Orlando, a guy named Todd Harper, who's a good friend of mine. He started this thing about 20 years ago called Generous Giving. And they don't tell you where to give. They don't tell you how to give, which is puzzling, right? Because it's, what am I doing? So they convene conversations around the topic of generosity. So we just did an annual conference 2 weeks ago. I've been to, I think, 6 of them. I pretty much go every year, and will continue to. It's fantastic. And it's 500 people who have been blessed from a resource perspective, time, talent, money, beyond just money, but been blessed from different perspectives. And all they do is get up and share who they believe owns it and what they believe their responsibility is, and then what they've done, not in a braggadocious sense. You can go to generousgiving.com and see some of these vignettes, these stories about, and you can judge for yourself, but it's basically people living out their life and allowing other people to see how they're expressing their gratitude through generosity, with the hope that that might trigger a thought in your head and as to how you might, or a feeling in your heart as to why you might, or both. And the hope is that it spurs you to greater generosity. And so anyway, it's that the majority of my view on things actually was spurred by a Generous Giving conference I attended in 2010.
Were there any major battles that you've had to essentially become the man you are now and the man you're becoming in terms of generosity, in terms of being a man of faith, being a business owner? Like, have you had any major struggles in this journey that you can kind of share with us and how it impacted you?
Oh, sure. And it's an active struggle. So yeah. it's not a battle won. Yeah. It's a battle being fought. And it goes back to what we said, or talked about a minute ago. And to keep things simple, that's in everything I do, I try to make things simple. I need pictures and books. but in terms of keeping it simple, it's, the question of, to whose glory is it? Meaning when you buy a new outfit, is it to make yourself look better? Or, the point is, it's to keep it really simple. That's the, and the world, every single TV show, and my 6-year-old daughter, I'll always, this is either good or bad, but she'll watch TV shows and, sparingly, but a commercial will come on and she'll say, here's what they're trying to sell me, or this is what they're trying to make me believe. So I've tried to tell her that commercial is trying to tell you you're not beautiful unless they use you put this stuff on your face. And she just thinks that, she looks at me like, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. But the point is, we as adults, we get immune to it. We're told every single day that we need to glorify ourselves with, look at us, our product. That's the battle every day, because we're sold it every day. And the question is, if you're not actively fighting it and saying that's a false narrative, you know, I was riding my Peloton bike yesterday morning and the instructor was giving me a lot of motivational stuff, but a lot of it was false narratives. And so when I'm listening to it, I'm like, okay, I see what you're trying to do, but that's false. I don't think that's a true statement.
Yeah. Give me an example of what a trainer.
Well, I mean, you know, her comment yesterday was, gosh, what was it? I'll come back. I'll be okay. Thinking about it. It was a truth claim that she was making, and okay. she was saying it when everybody was out of breath and too tired to say that that's false.
Like, so, I could keep going 100 more miles. Or
well,
something.
It, no, it was like, you know, you were something like you were made to finish this workout, or you were made to do, or you were something. It was something like that. I'm like, no, that's a truth claim. And I reject that as true. I don't think that's, you know, it's motivational. Yeah, I can, you hear it and you're like, yeah, yeah, but is it true? And that's the thing, is every single day we're sold messages, and I try to be better at saying, is that true or is it false? And you'd be surprised if you actually practice that, how many false things are true. It's just truth claims.
Right on. All right. So kind of wrapping this into the education and the training. So you grew up pretty successful, like even running your own business, you started acquiring properties, started making money, you got married, you guys started building a business. You took some time to kind of look for the moat, look for mm-hmm. the business that is doesn't go yo-yo and roller coaster. Mm-hmm. So you found mobile home parks and storage facilities. Mm-hmm. So then what was the next step? Is that when kind of elevation?
Yeah, so so we started buying, Jamie and I started buying mobile home parks and self-storage, you know, in the kind of early mid-2000s. And then we built a somewhat small portfolio compared to today. But it was great, you know, and to me, the thing we've always had is, you know, beyond, we didn't have delusions of grandeur, meaning I've never said, here's how much money I want to make. I have a fire in my belly and every day I want to do better. More. It's like that saying, again, faster. You know, I want to do it better. So that's our focus. So we started building, bought one mobile home park, two, three, four, five. And along the way, I gave a talk in Boston, and a guy came up to me afterwards. Short story, we became fast friends. He was 60 some odd years old. I think at the time I was 24, 25. Why he saw anything of value in me, I have no idea. Call it a moment of weakness on his behalf. But
you fooled him.
Yeah. If he only knew. But thankfully, he didn't. So his name's Rush. And Rush and I became close friends. And about a year or two later, he said, hey, you know, he saw us building our business, working hard, all these things. And he said, you know, I've got a friend of mine I want to introduce you to. He's one of my close friends. And he's somebody you would want to meet. He currently owns and operates something like 55,000 units, I think at that point we were at somewhere between 500 and 1,000 units ourselves. And here's an opportunity to meet somebody who owns 55,000. I didn't even know how to,
1,000.
I couldn't even quantify that. So I said, I'd love to meet him. Time and place, let me know. And most people say time and place, but they don't mean it. So he called me back. I think it was a couple of days later at night, and he goes, Brian's available to meet you. He said, but he can only meet you tomorrow at 6 o'clock in Newport Beach, California, or in Orlando, right? So we jump on the first flight out in the morning, fly cross country, land, get changed in the airport. Flight was late, so we get dressed, you know, to be presentable. We pull in for 15 minutes to spare, and we have dinner with him. And the whole dinner, all he's doing is asking me questions about us. He's asking us questions and questions and questions. And it was driving me nuts with respect to him, because I didn't come to learn more about myself.
Yeah, you wanted to
ask him. You're the man. I'm not the man. Don't treat me like I'm the man. We both know that's not the case. And so at the end of the meal, he goes, you know, I'm really impressed with what you guys have done. He said, for the next 30 minutes, I'm going to stay. And if there are questions I can, you know, if there's something I'm knowledgeable on that can help you, just ask. And so my question was, how do you grow a business of 55,000 units? Well, interestingly, he pulled out a napkin and a pen and he diagrammed it for me, like the blueprint, right? And so on the homepage of our website, to this day, I give honor to him. I nod to, nobody knows what this is, but on the cover of our webpage, there's a scene with a train track that goes 100 miles in the distance, and you can see 100 miles in the distance. The reason I picked that image is going to dinner with him that night, that I knew I was on the right track, pun intended, But it was covered in dense fog. So I was in the, I knew I was on the right track. I just couldn't see. So I didn't know if the cliff was 5 feet ahead. I didn't think it was, but coming after this, that 30 minutes blew all the fog off my tracks and I could see 100 miles in the distance. I knew I was on the right track and I knew how to get, I can now see where I was going. To shorten the story from that meeting, we went on, took what he gave us, as advice, and we ended up going from 500,000 units to 2 to 3 to 5 to 10 to 15, you know, so on and so forth. So we grew the portfolio over time. So we grew our portfolio, he grew his portfolio, and then around 2013 we started talking about maybe coming together. He was amazed at what we did, and at the entire time we gave him full credit, and more so, and this is something my wife did that I thought was exceptional, which she is. She's about as brilliant an EQ person as I've ever met. She's also high IQ, but she's brilliant EQ.
All right, for those listening, what is EQ?
EQ is emotional intelligence, relational intelligence. She's got it and more from that. Yeah. So she just listen to this quick tidbit. She valued Brian, this gentleman who invested into us, so much that she actually found out who mentored him. Okay. And she wrote him a letter, Mr. Bonner, who was 90 years old, thanking him for mentoring Brian, because as a result of his investment in Brian, we got many seeds of value that came from his tree.
Wow.
And so, you know, here's Brian, like, you know, his mentor to a degree, thanking him for the, you know, it was an exceptional gesture. So Brian was, you know, Brian's probably one of our closest friends to this day. I've learned probably more from him than anybody. And he's actually a business partner in Elevation. We do funds, and the three people in charge of the fund, you know, like Fund 7, our current one, is Jamie, myself, and Brian. So it's full circle.
How'd you come up with the name Elevation Capital Group?
Pretty, you know, once again, it made sense. We want to make things better. So I wanted something that evidences, you know, taking something from X and making it Y, Y being better than X.
Okay. Faster again, right?
Yeah, again, faster, but better. You know, so every day we wake up and we try to make things better.
Yeah. Prior to hit and record, you say you do about 12 talks a year and you travel around educating people, investors and people who wish to become investors. But, you know, I thought it was so valuable that I'd like you to kind of dig into that a little bit so we can, us as an audience could grow and expand our knowledge. You said that there's a difference between income and the value of income.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So it's, to start, I'll say it's probably one of the best lessons that I've learned that I wish I would have known when I was 20, but didn't, because it informs everything you do. And so to restate it, it's most people are cash flow focused. You go to a job, you get a check, it's income. So when you buy a property, what you want to do is you want to generate enough income to replace your job. And that's very, me too. So I'm in the bucket. I was there, get it, got it. I've seen the light. So there's a focus on income rather than the value of income. And so let me lastly say, to kind of go into this in more specifics, a lot of times, me included when I was younger, you see other people who have had financial results in their life that are 20, 30, 40, 50 times more than yours, but it appears you're doing the same thing. So there's a question. It's like, what do they know that I don't?
Yeah.
Right? And in my opinion, what they know that most people don't is the value of income, not income. So let me break it apart. So let's say, conceptually first, I guess you have to understand that the value of an income producing business is a multiple on the income it produces. Right? So lemonade stand kind of example. So let's say with a property. So if I buy a mobile home park and I can add $1 a month of net income. So gross income minus all expenses. So if it's $1 a month, right, that's $12 a year. And mobile home parks, and I'm just going to simplify it. Let's say a mobile home park trades for 20 times earnings, which is about right. Maybe a little high, but let's say 20 times earnings. So that $1 a month is $12 a year times 20. It's $240 of value, equity. The value of the business has gone up $240 because I have $1 a month. Okay. So now if you have 10 units and you can add $1 a month, what do you have? you have 2,400.
2,400.
If you have 100 units, it's 24,000. If you have 1,000 units, it's 240,000. So if you have 1,000 units, every $1 is $240,000 in equity that you just made. So if you were able to then extrapolate that out, if you were able to buy a property and grow the NOI by $4 a month on 1,000 units, you're a millionaire. So the only thing standing in your way from being a millionaire is $4 times 1,000 units. So I'm gonna do one other thing in a second, but before I get there, let's go back to the $1 example. So if you have $1 of income, that's $12 a year. That's income, that's ordinary income. You have to pay tax on that currently. I'm just talking current tax regime. You have to pay tax on that, right? So let's assume you pay 40% tax or whatever you pay. So in that case, you make 12, you know, you have $12 of gross income. Let's just say you net after tax is $8. Okay, so an income investor is saying, I got $8. Okay. Somebody who understands the value of income is saying, I have $240. And the interesting thing is, because it's unrealized, how much tax do you pay on 240?
Zero.
So the person who has, and somebody listening says, well, it's unrealized. My $8 is in my pocket. Your 240 is on paper. Not so fast. I can go to a bank and refinance that 240 at 60% leverage. So what's 60% of 240? Let's just say it's 150 off the roughly $150, right? So I can go to a bank, borrow the 150, right? And how much tax do I pay on the borrowings?
Zero.
So not so fast. You have $8 in your pocket. I have 150.
Eight, right?
Right. I have one. You have $8. I have 150.
Yeah.
After tax. Plus, I still have $90 more in equity, and you don't have any more income. So to go back, so I'm gonna do one more thing, because I think, let's say, and this is kind of a fun exercise. So what do you want to make in life? You know, what's your goal?
My goal?
Well, yeah, I don't want to put you on blast and make you state that, but the point is, what, you know, if you're listening to this, what's your goal? And what's interesting is a lot of people don't really have a specific goal, and that's okay too. I didn't either, but let's just say $10 million. Is your goal. Or a million, you can do whatever you want. Let's say $10 million. Okay. So if a property is roughly, that you're buying is roughly 20 times, you know, 20 times income to value, a 5 cap in this example. So take $10 million divided by 20.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's 500,000. So you need 500,000 of NOI to be worth $10 million. Okay. So how many units do you want to own? All right, let's do it another way first. So if you have $500,000, let's get it into monthly increments first. So let's do months. So if you have $500,000 divided by 12, that's roughly $41,000 a month. So you need, if you could generate $41,000 a month of additional NOI at a property or properties, you're worth $10 million. Okay. Now, how many units do you want to have? Let's just say 1,000. So I'm going to divide the 41,000 by 1,000 units. That gives you $41. So if you had 1,000 units and you grew the NOI by $41, okay,
then
you're worth $10 million. So last question, how long do you want to take to do that? How long do you think it'll take you to do that? Okay, let's say 5 years.
Sure.
And some people say, I'm going to do it in a year. Why be in a hurry? The numbers aren't changing. The model's not changing. Do it. Do what is the best next step. Do it right. Don't do it quick. My favorite quote is, be quick, but don't hurry, by John Wooden. But let's say it takes you 5 years. Okay, that's $8.33. So let me put this into other terms. If I were to offer you $8 today, you'd say, oh, thanks, I'll buy a coffee. But that $8, if you buy a property or properties, 1,000 units, occupied units, and you find a way to grow the NOI of those properties by $8.33 a year for the next 5 years, you're worth $10 million in equity, assuming the cap rate is still 5% or 20 times earnings.
Did you guys catch all that? Like, this is so interesting, because, you know, when I was, and this might be your story too, is the advice that was given to me was, go to school, make a lot of money, work at a corporation for 30 years or a job, retire, and then you get to live the life that you want after 30, 35 years. And I went down that road and I tried it and I found a lot of flaws in it. But you're sharing like the power of income, not necessarily how much you're making, but what you're doing with the money you're making actually makes a difference 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now.
Right. And it's all the same thing. So if you're an employee in a business, you are working every day, and there's nothing wrong with this. By the way, if you feel called to be an employee and to provide value, do it. It's honorable. Having a job is honorable. I would, if I had to sweep floors as a janitor, I would do it with joy, because the point is there's honor in work of any type. So mine isn't better than another's. But at the same time, what most people do is they spend their time going to an employer that uses them in some capacity to generate income. And unless that employee has access to equity or stock, they're actually not clued in or have any access to the value of the income, which is the owner. So the owner gets the value. They just get a paycheck. So it's the same thing that's in their business. What is every business you work for trying to do? Make more income. Yeah. Why? Because the value of that income is the value. You see what I'm saying? It's not about the cash flow. It's about the value of that cash flow.
So you and I are sitting here at a coffee table. Let's just say for some reason, someone made an accounting error, and you and I start with zero right this minute. Mm-hmm. We lose everything, and you and I are kind of scrounging around. We have $0 today. Mm-hmm. What would be our next best step?
Exactly what I just said. So I would, for me, it's the same thing I'm doing today, because it's, there's nothing that I had yesterday that's helping me today. My actions today are as if it's zero anyway. So it's not like there's any, every single person listening to this, podcast or this recording could do the same thing we're doing today, because there's not a requirement of success to take the steps we're taking today. So to me, I'd do the same. My day would look the same. Just finding property that produces income that we think we can add NOI to. Why is that important? We just went through it. So that's our goal. And then if you find a property where, like I said, so go back to that example. Let's say there was one property that you found and $8 a month, I can buy a property and raise it. I can add $10 a month for the next 5 years, and I'm sure of it. And it's a great property, and here's why. And that'll produce $10 million of value, or should at some point in time in the future. How hard is it to capitalize that?
You just got to start talking with people, right?
The point is you got to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Then you have to show them something that represents you knowing what you're doing. And then you have to give them the opportunity to choose yes or no, and that at the end of the day, if it's a good deal and you are believable and trustworthy in executing the strategy, and if people believe you're trustworthy and honest and your reputation precedes you, then, whether you have $100 million or $0, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's the latest book that you've been diving into?
That's a good question. several. So a book that I read recently, and my wife and I do this every year. We have a business plan, but we also have a marriage plan. We do an annual business plan for our marriage every year. And the book that we based that on is written by a friend of mine who's brilliant. He's the former president of Continental Airlines, who's the CEO of Burger King and Quiznos, and he's on the board right now of Home Depot, so pretty bright guy. But it's called Right Away and All at Once by Greg Brenneman. And beyond other things he says, he believes that any company can be turned around with a plan that sits on one sheet of paper. No plan longer than one sheet of paper he thinks will work or work well. So it's a great book. I enjoyed that. We just did a study with a group of friends called Life Together by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which I loved. Last week we finished a book called Basic Christianity by John Stott, which was great. If you're also looking for more information or to learn more about viewing your work as a mission field, for those of you who have that kind of faith-based lens, Every Good Endeavor by Tim Keller is exceptional. And then I could go on and on and on, but I believe that you believe that. The last book, if you're married and want a good book on marriage, that Jamie and I have loved, It's also Tim Keller, called The Meaning of Marriage. We give that to people who get engaged. That's a great book.
So I want to do something for our audience right now. For the first person who kind of like sends in a message about this, I'm going to buy you the book, Every Good Endeavor by Tim Keller. So the first one to kind of shoot me an email or a message, that'll be my gift to you. So this is kind of a hidden Easter egg within the podcast. But that I'm going to buy that today. And if someone in the audience wants to read it with me, we'll do that. So back to you, Ryan. If people want to learn more about you, your business at Elevation, or the things that you're working on, where can people go to find you, connect with you?
Yeah, so feel free to, if I could be ever of help or connect you with a community or an idea or share anything that has been, we have found valuable to us, happy to do it. My direct line is 407-602-7662, and that reaches me in the office. And then my email is ryan@elevationcg.com.
Cool. Are there any questions that I should have asked you that I totally missed the mark on and I screwed up and I didn't ask you?
That's a good question. It presumes I know a lot more than I do. No, I think you've done a fantastic job, and I think your listeners are lucky to have you.
I'm lucky to have them too. All right. Well, Ryan, thanks for this interview, for this conversation that we had, and I hope there's many more to come, and there's some really interesting people that you mentioned. I want to give some shout outs. So if you're listening, I'd love to get you on the show one day. Eddie from Lift Orlando, Mike Kelly from the Orlando Society, NCF, Generous Giving, Todd Harper, and Greg Benjamin. You know, any of you guys want to have a chat and share your mission on the show, be happy to chat with you. Ryan, thanks for coming on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening in. Hope you had a wonderful day. Enjoy beautiful Orlando. Talk to you soon. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening in on today's episode. If you would like to be a guest on the show or start up a conversation with me, Josh, your host, send me an email to josh@orlandoentrepreneurs.org. You could also find out more information on Orlando's entrepreneurial ecosystem, discover resources to help you start and grow your business, and subscribe to future shows by visiting www.orlandoentrepreneurs.org.